Okay, so I'm sure I'll just repeat your question there just to make sure everyone understands. So Ben's just raising the concern that even though the traditional ordination lineage from the Mahayana schools is based on the Theravadan or the early Buddhism ordination, Vinaya, similar to ours, but they, in addition to that, they take a set of what they call Bodhisattva precepts, which is kind of sits on top of the basic ordination. Now, most of the Bodhisattva precepts are fairly innocuous, but there's one precept in, I'm not sure if it's universally found, but at least in some sets of Bodhisattva precepts, I'm not sure how standardized they are. We maybe should get some advice on that. But there's one precept in some versions which says that the true Bodhisattva would not study or teach the what they call Hinayana teachings, which, and Hinayana is usually understood as meaning the early Buddhism teachings, okay? And so this obviously is a little bit kind of weird, frankly, and a bit disturbing. So then the question is what impact that has. It would be interesting to talk to somebody who has some more knowledge of the history of the Mahayana traditions to get some more details on that. I would just make a couple of remarks now. One remark is exactly how the word Hinayana is meant to be interpreted, because Hinayana is a derogatory term, which means basically means the rubbish vehicle. Okay, Hina is literally what has been thrown away. Okay, so Hinayana doesn't mean small vehicle. It's sometimes translated. It literally means the rubbish vehicle. Right. So, what was that author in that time actually intending by that? Right. Now, that's a complex question which has been much debated by modern scholars. What actually are the Mahayanists referring to in those texts when they're referring to that? And it seems likely that they, rather than referring to early Buddhist teachings as a whole, that they were referring to contemporary things that they saw around them in contemporary Buddhism, particularly the Sarvastivadin school in northern India. Say when these precepts were composed, which would have been maybe 1st, 2nd century AD, okay? So at that time in northern India, the Sarvastivadin school was very strong, and these things are probably meant as a criticism of the contemporary Sarvastivadin school rather than of actually early Buddhism as a whole. So that's one point. It may not have been interpreted in that way through history, so that doesn't necessarily solve the problem, but that's one point. Another point is that if you look at, and actually probably a much more important point, is that if you look at the teachings of the great Mahayana philosophers and scholars, Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, Asanga, and almost all of them, in fact, they are very, very thoroughly versed in the teachings of the early Buddhism. And for example, Nagarjuna, who's known as the most famous of Mahayana philosophers, his chief work is called the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, and that's almost entirely based on suttas from the Sanyutta Nikaya. Yeah? Similarly, Asanga, who's the greatest Mahayana commentator, he's equivalent to Buddhaghosa in the Theravadan tradition. Asanga plays a similar role within the Mahayana tradition. And his work is primarily based on the Agamas or the early suttas, and he only refers to the Mahayana sutras when he's discussing specific Mahayanist doctrines. So his whole basic scheme of his teaching is based on the early suttas. And so, you know, since these are literally the key, most important figures comparable to, say, Buddhaghosa within the Theravadan tradition, and they are thoroughly versed in the early sutras, so it seems that that precept can't have meant that they didn't study the early Buddhism at all, or that they didn't have respect for it. It must have meant something much more specific.
Important statement. So I'd just like to pass it on.
How much research has been done as to the reasons for the decline of the dying out of the
Yeah. So the question. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The question is, has there been much research into the decline of the Bhikkhuni Sangha? I think there's just very little evidence, and that's the problem. There's actually like a massive vacuum of historical evidence in ancient Buddhism anyway. We're really scratching around for decent historical information on anything, really. The Buddhist texts themselves are mainly concerned with philosophy and meditation and so on. The Hindu texts are thoroughly unreliable. The archaeological evidence is very scarce. I mean, to give you an idea of the problems, in ancient India, the great capital of King Ashoka was Pataliputra, which is modern-day Patna. And that was a massive metropolis, probably the biggest city in the world at the time, comparable in every respect to ancient Rome. Okay, and yet there's not been not one proper archaeological dig in Patna. Okay, not one properly documented archaeological work done in Patna. So there's a great absence of evidence, and the lack of evidence around the decline of the Bhikkhuni Sangha is just a symptom of that. All we can really say is that that they seem to have died out in Sri Lanka around the 11th century. And we don't really hear much of them after that.
Excuse me, if I could just say that the Bhikkhuni Sangha is only officially thought to have gone to Sri Lanka and not to have been established in the other Southeast Asian Theravada countries. So when we're talking about the dying out of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, we usually look to the Sri Lankan experience. And that generally is taken as having happened because of invasion from south of India, non-Buddhist forces, and a famine in the country at the time. And it's noteworthy that the Bhikkhu Sangha also died out in Sri Lanka, and the ordination was brought back from Burma originally to re-establish it. It was just not possible at that time to re-establish the Bhikkhuni Sangha for whatever reason.
And there is evidence that the Bhikkhuni Sangha was established at the same time.
There is, but it's not universally acknowledged.
Yeah. There's a few suggestions and hints, but there's not a real solid case. I mean, that's something, again, where it would be very interesting to see results of some more research. But at the moment, all we can say is that there are a few references. There's paintings, inscriptions here and there, which seem to suggest that there may have been bhikkhunis at one time or another in Burma and or Thailand. But we can't say much more than that. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the most interesting ones. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the most interesting ones. But these things sometimes come out of nowhere. But there's apparently a reference in a royal edict from Burma. It's twice, I think, one in 1800 and one in 1810 or something like that, both of which refer to bhikkhunis, both to bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and it's in the context of ordination or something like that, like how the ordination is to be performed or something like that. So the word occurs in those edicts. Does that mean that they were there? You could make arguments either way. You could point, for example, to the fact that those kinds of royal edicts, okay, regarding the Sangha, the earliest versions of those edicts we have are the Ashokan edicts, okay, made by King Ashoka. King Ashoka always referred to bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. Yeah, so perhaps the authors of those Burmese edicts were merely following the pattern or the literary form, and as a matter of form we're referring to bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. So again, it's until more thorough work is really done, it's difficult to draw too much conclusions. My feeling is that there probably were bhikkhunis, but it's difficult to prove that. We had in Santi Monastery a few weeks ago, we visited by Peter Skilling, who's probably the leading professor in the world dealing with these things. He lives in Bangkok, and among other things, he's the head of the Early Manuscripts Project, or what they call the Fragile Palm Leaves Project, you may have heard of. Collects palm leaf manuscripts from around Burma and Thailand and preserves them. And he's a great scholar and lives in Thailand, and I asked him this question, and he said, yeah, basically there isn't really enough evidence to say too much one way or the other. Well, I think I don't think that things would change very much in that regard. I don't know, Atamayama might have some points. The question, the thing you say about using the title sisters, we've had quite a bit of discussion about this and similar points, and it seems to be an interesting one. Of course, the question of what titles you to use and so on. Actually, in the Pali, they do use the word sister. Yeah, not as a title, but as a term of address they use, sister, Bhagini. I know that the East Asian bhikkhunis seem to not like the use of the word sister at all, and I think they, I think it's become the custom, or seems to have become quite common in Malaysia, Singapore, Taiwan, and places for the lay Buddhists call each other brother and sister. That seems to be quite a common usage. I don't know, for myself, growing up in a Catholic background, I mean, sister was a term you used for a nun. You know, straight away, you never used it among the lay people. So it really just depends on the connotations. You know, when I use a title, to me, it's a title I used to refer to a nun. So it's meant in a very respectful way. But obviously, contemporary Asian culture is a bit different that way. So we respect that. Usually we just use like venerable, or the other term that we use is ayah, which is the actual Pali term. But I understand that ayah is not a very respectful word in Sri Lankan, is that right? In Sinhala?
It sounds like the singular word for older brother. Yes, so it's problematic in that respect.
Old brother's not too bad though.
And also because it means the domestic.
A domestic?
Yes. Domestic servant, yes. The who looks after the children.
Okay.
It's just that in our mouth that they sound all the same, you see.
Yes.
They actually don't sound the same when a Sri Lankan person speaks, but when we say them. I think they're the final points that we would look at. We have considered, but we've, the big issues have to be worked through first, and then after that, these other issues can be also addressed. Mm. And we're very open about that. It seems to be that most people are comfortable with venerable, a non-gender-specific term for males and females.
Yep. In India, we were using... In India, we were using Ayaji, which I think is quite cute. Ayaji? Oh, G is just a word you use in India. I think it's just a respectful thing you put at the end of anything in India. So Ayaji is just a venerable G. So if anyone has any more questions, now's a good time. If we've got a bit of a break in the questions, then we were thinking of maybe inviting some of the nuns to speak and have a bit of a say about how they feel about bhikkhuni ordination. Do you think it would be a good time to do that now? I've got one more question at the back. We mentioned that briefly inside there. There's certainly no Vinaya precedent for that. but it is something which could be organised informally among the community if they wish to. So I kind of thought that it would be nice to do something like that, at least on an informal basis, to introduce the new ordinance and so on. But yeah, that would be a matter for, that would be like an informal matter to be worked out by the Sangha, yeah. So maybe you want to pass the microphone down.
I think there's one here, isn't there? Do you like to go here?
Oh.
Sister Niroda, for those who don't know me, to the question, why do I want to become a bhikkhuni? Why not? Just like to tell a short story. There was a couple who lived together till they were in the 80s. And then the woman said to the man, they were not married, he said, shouldn't we get married? And the man said, who would have us now? So if we want to see something happening, we have to be actively involved, but not, I haven't got this, the real sort of strong desire to become a bhikkhuni. I think it's happening. And I feel, rather than a sort of worldly desire for status and all that, I would feel greatly enriched spiritually by being able to lead a bhikkhuni's life with a proper patimokkha, with a proper framework. And what has been happening in Perth now for such a long time, especially under the guidance of Ajahn Brahman, especially under our abbot Ajahn Vayama, the conditions are all there. The conditions are all there for a long time now. And I think, I dare say, we all have proven through our conduct that there has been no scandal. We have tried to live a very, very high standard of behavior, but also of practice. Of course, many years have been spent now in building up Dhammasara Nuns Monastery, and we're already now to move on to the next phase, which is more intensive practice and actually realize the goal of why we went forth. So my immense gratitude go not only to the head of the Sangha here, also to Ajahn Suchato, but also to you all who make it possible for all of us in this very life to go much further than we probably sort of imagine on our own, in our own way. So I like to say that not to underestimate, we're talking about legalistic points of view. It's like establishing an institution, which is very important, but I think it goes far more than that. And I'm very deeply touched, and I would be very deeply enriched by being able to go to the final step. So probably I will remember a few more things later on, but that's all I have to say for now. Thank you. Just remember one more thing I wanted to say. My robe is constantly falling down. If I have a proper bhikkhuni robe and can wear it the way the monks are wearing it, I would feel more comfortable. Thank you.
For myself, yes, I would like to be ordained as a bhikkhuni.
I must say I'm very well informed and well educated with all the arguments and about and the legal side of the issues of Armenia and all the questions that we have discussed here. But to me, it's not that really matter. All it matters is the heart connection. I know that I'm not a full member of the Sangha. I would like to be. It gives me great inspiration and faith to be able to make this heart connection to be a fully a Dorje of the Buddha. I'm aware the true Dorje of the Buddha is one who's an enlightened. But at least I would like to be, if conditions are right, I would like to be a true Dorje of the Buddha. And then I know that I'm sort of like making this connection with the Buddha and the Sangha of 2,500 years. And I know that I'm walking. I'm shaking because I'm very emotional about it. I'm really walking very closely, step by step, with like what the Buddha have been doing, and step by step, close steps to all the sanghas, especially the Bhikkhuni Sangha, have been practicing 2,500 years, and that gives me enormous amount of inspiration and faith. I've been in the monastery for 7 years now. There's nothing really that much required in my review to sustain or to keep living as monastic. But the inspiration and the faith is very important. I hope it will take me one step deeper and closer to be a true Dorje of the Buddha. And I just want to say that I actually went to the Bhikkhuni seminar last year in March in Sydney, Santi, and I met a Bhikkhuni. When I asked her, you know, when we talk about what is it the difference? Like someone asked, what is the difference? Why you want to become a Bhikkhuni? And she said to me, it is the power that she ordained you. The power that connect her with all this energy and this Sangha in the past and the Buddha. That's give her, that's how she felt she's much more, that she's more inspired. And I can tell you that I could see the twinkle of happiness and faith in her eyes. And I still remember the feeling of inspiration that when she speaks to me. So I remember that. Come and say hi. That's one of my inspiration too. And another thing is like I felt that I will not no longer just practice for myself. I connected with this big, huge energy of monks and nuns, not just monks. It gives me much more of a power to say I must keep practicing and keeping the precepts because I'm representing the Sangha. I'm not just representing myself. And I hope, I wish my aspiration will inspire many female practitioners now and in the future, and also may benefit more practitioners now in the future, and we will have more people free from liberation and suffering. That's my deepest wish. Thank you.
I have to step forward. No, it's fine. Okay. I think I'm fine. I'm fine now. You're sitting on that one. Actually, I was being asked the same questions why I want to become a bhikkhuni. When I went back to Malaysia in March to visit my families, and I had a discussion with a very senior monk, and he asked me, why do you want to become a bhikkhuni? Why you just be contented with just 10 precept nuns, you know? It makes life easier and more convenient, you know? It's so inconvenient keeping all these rules. So then my reaction is, and I was thinking, you asked me I should be contented with 10 precepts. Why cannot you just be contented with 5-10 precepts instead of asking me if you said not that important? And then, you know, you should be living by example. You just keep 10, you ask me to keep 10 precepts. But I didn't say that, I just bite back my tongue. And then I answer him that, you know, I wanted to become a bhikkhuni. It's not because I want the status, that because of I'm keeping morals, then it shows that I'm purer, I'm more superior, and not because of that. It's because of to undertake the training rules with understanding. Like I understand that the rules is to help me and support me in my practice. It's just like all the Buddhists are keeping 5 precepts. Like the non-Buddhists will think that you're silly to keep all those 5 precepts. But you know that if the precepts really helped you to support you in your practice. And the same, this is just how I felt, you know. To me, I'm just a simple person. To me, it's just as simple as that. And another question that I used to be asked, they ask, what are you? Are you a bhikkhuni? Are you a, you know, samanari? I said, not quite samanari. So I'm 10 precept nun. What is 10 precept nuns? So to me, it's so complicated. You're either a nun or not a nun. You're either a monk or not a monk. But, you know, in Theravada tradition, we have all this Siladhara and Meiji and Siale and 10 precepts nun, Samanari. It's so complicated. So I was thinking just to become a bhikkhuni and then make life much easier and simpler. So, and actually, yeah, this is my motivation. And also because also I'm also noted for myself how, for me, I personally feel that like being a nun or a monk, there's a responsibilities and the duties to keep the rules. If I want to have a convenience to do what I like, I just don't become a nun then. You know, if I want to become a nun, and then Buddha's never said that everybody have to become a nun or monk to practice Buddhism. So if I want to be convenient to do what I like, so I can just be a lay person to practice Buddhism, not to become a nun then. So, and then moreover, now we are not doing something new. And because a bhikkhuni is already, you know, there's this bhikkhuni's order, it's already established, Buddha's already established it in 2600 years ago, and then we are not doing something new. We are just doing something that is already laid down by the Buddhas and being established by the Buddha before. So, to me, you know, that's it. So that's my reason of becoming a bhikkhuni.
So we've got about another 15 minutes or so. We're supposed to wrap up around 5 o'clock. So I don't know if anyone has any further questions, comments, or as I said last night, if anyone has any good jokes while Ajahn Brahm's away, they can keep us amused. Thank you very much, Prem. I think that's a very good point, and what we do here will have an effect. And also it's important, just to come back to the thing before you mentioned about, like, it struck me when you say, you know, be content with 10 precepts, and if you've got 10 precepts, hey, why not be content with 8? And if you've got 8, you can just be content with five. And if you've got five, well, you could just be content with none at all. That would be the most content. To come to that point of that kind of global influence and global networking is very, very important, very crucial. And one point to make, which is quite significant but which we might overlook, is that our decision influences that whether or not we make a decision. And that not taking bhikkhuni ordination can be, and in fact is, taken by bhikkhus in, say, Thailand and other places as a sign that there must be something wrong with bhikkhuni ordination. And so this is another argument that you sometimes hear. And so, say, monks in Thailand, sometimes, an argument that sometimes you hear is, well, even those monasteries in the West, like Ajahn Sumedho or Ajahn Brahm, even they're not doing bhikkhuni ordination. You know, they're living in the West where there's all equality and so on and so forth, and they don't have the weight of cultural traditions and expectations that we have. It'd be very easy for them to do bhikkhuni ordination, but still they're not doing it. So there must be some good reason why not. And even those good Vinaya traditions, yeah, are not doing bhikkhuni ordination. Therefore, there must be a reason why there's something wrong with it. So this is another argument which I've heard from Thai monks. So that kind of global influence is felt, whether we recognize it or not. That actually is felt, and it's felt, it'll be felt either way. Yeah, so it's very important that we set that kind of good example.
Can I just make a point, please? I'd just like to make a point about that. One reason why we haven't proceeded with bhikkhuni ordination before, and why we're able to think about it now, is because we have such good conditions of support here in Perth, and we've always been of the opinion that it's not useful for the reputation of the bhikkhuni sangha if you take the ordination and don't keep the training rules. And many bhikkhunis, unfortunately, are in the position where they don't have good support, so they can't live according to the training rules in their community, and that in turn gives them makes a less than favourable impression on the lay people or on other bhikkhus, who then say, "Oh, see, we told you they can't keep those silly rules today in modern society." So we've always been very aware of not creating that sort of impression and waiting until we can be sure that we can keep the rules well. And we are very confident, because of the structure that we've set up and the support that we've received, that if we do proceed with bhikkhuni ordination, that we'll be able to live the life well and fully, and be a good example not only for other bhikkhunis, but also to make the impression to the bhikkhu sangha in the world elsewhere, that it is possible to live within the rules if there is sufficient material support to do so. So Peng is making the offering on behalf of people that she'd like to offer support for us to proceed. So perhaps we could just ask if there are any dissenting voices at this stage, and perhaps we can do our last little bit to convince them. And then if we could accept that Peng is speaking on behalf of the community here, that would be... There is a... Someone up at the back. Don is also seconding it. So it would be more than we really hoped for to come out of this meeting with some sort of formal declaration from the meeting that you offer support for us proceed with this, but certainly that would be wonderful if that can be received, if that can be given.
Okay.
usually in the vinaya procedures, if there's anyone who wishes to dissent, then they should speak up. So if there's no dissenting voices, then that's usually taken as implying consensus. Let's do the ordination then, Venerable. Let's get a couple of monks down from Perth. And so thanks, Lynn. That's question is there'll be a meeting in December. They call the WAM, the World Abbots Meeting, and it's a meeting of Western Abbots Meeting, is it? Okay, a bit more modest. Anyway, and so a lot of it's basically a meeting of the senior leaders in the Ajahn Chah tradition, Western Branch Monasteries. They hold every few years, and this year they're holding it in the Jhana Grove. So that'll be in December. So I think Ajahn Sumedha will be here, Ajahn Pasanoa, many of the leaders from the monasteries in England and America and so on. And so obviously this will be one of the issues on the agenda. So this will be discussed at that time. Obviously we don't know what the outcome of that discussion will be. The WAM is not a kind of a formal decision-making body. It's just a discussion forum. So there's no kind of expectation that there either will or won't be a kind of formal decision made there, but it will be a chance to bring the issue and discuss it. And my the impression or the feedback that I get from the different branch monasteries of the Ajahn Chah tradition around the world is that most people seem to feel that bhikkhuni ordination will take place inevitably sometime, but they don't necessarily have... you know, they don't have a time frame or they're not kind of working necessarily actively towards it. So my feeling is, and it's just my personal feeling, is that the response of most of the Ajahns there will be to look with interest at the developments here and to sort of support it in spirit and to see how things go with the possibility, eventuality of introducing it to perhaps in England and America and so on as well. There's another question. Sorry, Chair, you had a question. So the question about Bhikkhuni Dhammananda. Yeah, and well, you say caused a controversy. I don't know if she caused one. Certain people caused controversy. And there was somebody who used to write articles in the paper and so on, criticising her. And when she arrived back from her ordination, she saw that fellow was there, and she just went up to him and said, "It's just an old woman getting ordained. There's nothing to be excited about." Yeah. So her case was very interesting because she was a very prominent figure in Thai society. She was a university professor. And she was actually like the kind of Oprah Winfrey of Thailand for many years. She had a daytime TV chat show, okay? Chiwetmai Sinwang, Life is Not Without Hope. And so she would do this. So she was a very well-known personality in Thai society. So when she took bhikkhuni ordination and also as a respected university teacher, she obviously had some substance to that. So, of course, there's actually many bhikkhunis now ordained in Thailand. I think about 30 or 40. But she's by far the most publicly prominent, although there are other bhikkhuni monasteries that have quite a lot more bhikkhunis staying there. As far as I'm in quite regular contact with her by email, and saw her, when did I last see her? Not too long ago, probably in December at the conference in New Zealand. That's right, and she came to our monastery in around December, and we had a seminar, bhikkhuni seminar in Sydney at that time. She's very well. The monastery seems to be going extremely well, and the controversy's basically pretty much died down, and she's getting on with her life and getting on with teaching and training nuns at her centre. Yeah. So at last, a very simple question. Can the ordination be backdated? No, it can't. To understand the issue, the most important thing, or most important context to remember, really, when it comes right down to it, the most important context is colonialism. Okay. Asian countries generally, and you know, third world countries, Asia, what we call today third world or Asian countries, were basically invaded and terrorized during the colonial era. Their wealth was taken away from them. Burma was the richest country in the world. They had very high standards of living. They had, you know, so there's a rich, very deep culture, and all of that was basically destroyed, or very largely destroyed and terrorized by Western countries for centuries. And that's created a sense of insecurity and a sense of needing in those countries, and needing to somehow retain or revitalize that sense of connection with their own historical roots. And in those countries, the Sangha and Buddhism and the Sangha in those countries provides that. It is the stable thing in all of this time of instability. It's that deep root in that time where we feel like our lives are being tossed around. It's that thing which we can feel has been always the same since the time of the Buddha. You know, it represents that continuity, that stability, and that sense of security in a world which has got so many things which are, you know, insecure and threatening us. So the feeling where that is coming from, you know, we can understand that there'd be a very that strong feeling of need, that, well, so many things have been taken from us. Yeah? So many things in our culture have been demeaned or threatened. Can't we at least keep one thing? Yeah? Can't we at least have this? And to the idea of just keeping that sort of sense of a continuity and richness with the ancient heritage. And I think this is where a lot of that feeling comes from. So I think it's important from our point of view is to sort of to emphasize that by introducing bhikkhuni ordination is not threatening that tradition, but is actually enhancing it. You know, it's actually completing it. There's been a preservation of that root of Buddhism, and it's because of our respect for that. It's because of our respect for the fact that traditional Buddhist countries, despite everything, despite all the wars and the famines and the changes and everything, have managed to keep the Dhamma alive and managed to keep the Sangha alive, that we're now able to have the benefit of that. And so we can contribute to our own way, to helping to grow that and flourish that in our own time.
It's 5 o'clock, so I think it might be now a suitable time to finish, unless there's anyone feels that they have a burning question that hasn't been answered. So I'd like to thank Acharya Sujata very much for making himself available to speak and answer questions this afternoon, and we're very appreciative that all of you who've come here today have had the interest to come and stay through the afternoon, and also to the interest to ask your questions and also to express your support. So we as a community express our gratitude to all of you, and from this meeting today we will discuss with the Acharya Brahm where we're going to go from here, to give him the feedback, and then to let you know what is the next step. So thank you all very much for being here, and if we could end by paying respects to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha.
Bye.